Good afternoon. So last time, we started looking at scheduling. We looked at the XV6 scheduler. The scheduler was what decided what ran on the CPU at what time. So when we did those context switches, it's the thing that decided, well, what thing are we going to switch to? We mentioned that XV6 had this global array to track all the processes, was a fixed size because XV6 was just trying to be simple and said, okay, we're not going to support an arbitrary number of processes. And XV6 also, to keep things simple, had this separate scheduler thread for every core. And the idea was you'd switch to that scheduler thread. That scheduler thread would have local variables that track the state of the scheduler, and then it would switch to the actual thing you wanted to run, rather than having some function which switched directly to the thing you wanted to run, which is another possible design, just means you can't use things like local variables. We saw that we had this lock to control changes to the process table, and a big thing is that we didn't want it to be the case that some sort of exception happened while we were trying to change what process was running, and in the middle of handling that, we got confused about whether the process was something we wanted to switch to or not. So our solution was this lock. We'll talk more about how locks work when we talk about threads and multi-threaded programming later in the semester. We also saw that because the scheduler had this global array of processes and didn't have many other data structures to track processes, it had these implicit queues where conceptually, like, there's a list of programs we're going to run, but the way XV6 actually tracked that is it just searched the entire array for things with a particular state, where if you wanted to be really efficient, it would probably make more sense to have, like, a separately maintained list that you update as those states change. So then we started looking at, like, well, you know, we know what the XV6 scheduler does. What should schedulers do? And to do this, we needed sort of a model of what programs do. And the model we're going to use is this one that programs have these CPU and I/O bursts. So that basically threads alternate between using the processor, the CPU, and waiting for input or output. And when they're waiting for input or output, other things can use the processor. And our sort of goal in scheduling processor time is to decide what CPU bursts to run of the ones that are ready to run. And our, you know, big question that we're going to look at for today and probably most of Thursday is what policy to have, which for this is basically what to remove from the queue. So this isn't an interesting question if there's only one thing we can run, but it is interesting when there's multiple choices and we have to choose between. And to decide how good a scheduling policy was, we needed some way of measuring that. And we talked about several metrics. So one was this throughput metric, which is the amount of useful work per unit time. And our main concern with throughput is that if we switch rapidly between programs, well, the work of actually doing that switching takes time. And that time is not useful work. That's what we call overhead. And we don't want to have too much overhead because then, you know, our system won't be getting much actual useful work done. Another metric we had was turnaround time. And this is for our, you know, CPU burst, the time from when something becomes runnable, so when we can start putting it on the processor, to when it actually finishes running and starts waiting for the next I/O operation. And so we actually have sort of a turnaround time for each CPU burst, and usually we're going to look at the mean turnaround time because that's easy to deal with analytically and kind of represents an average. You might say maybe this isn't the right average because this means that, you know, we're kind of treating outliers in a particular way, which maybe isn't right. You know, maybe we want to care more about the median turnaround time, but we're probably not going to do that just because it's actually hard to construct a scheduling policy which does that. Whereas, as we'll see later today, we actually have some very elegant ways of minimizing the mean turnaround time, which is a good approximation of any other sort of average turnaround time. Another metric we thought about was fairness. So this is that if we have multiple people sharing a system, we want to have their threads run as performantly as everyone else using the system, that we don't want one user to be disadvantaged or advantaged by our scheduling policy. And sort of one way we might be concerned about this is that if, like, we always run the first thing, well, you know, that means that one thing gets to run a lot more than the others just by sort of luck. And we might want to avoid that. And these metrics are generally in conflict, that minimizing turnaround time means that we want to switch to things that need to run quickly, that aren't going to use that, you know, that otherwise, you know, would have to wait a while to do very little bit of work. And that's going to mean doing more switching, which is going to hurt throughput. Making better fairness might mean switching between things more rapidly. So, you know, if we look at any period of time, everyone got a chance to run, which is going to conflict with throughput. And being fair might mean running things which, you know, aren't going to be able to finish running so soon, which is going to conflict with turnaround time. So these all sort of are in conflict with each other. So we're not going to be able to, like, make the perfect schedule if you're concerned about more than one of these, which usually we are. So the question is fairness, equality, or equity? And fairness has many definitions, and some of them are going to look like your notion of equality. Some of them might be have some other idea. So there's and it depends on exactly the details of what you measure. Whether it will, you know, look one way or the other. So we're going to talk about some schedulers later on, which are fair in very specific senses, in which case we'll be able to make a better judgment as to whether it's equitable or just equal. Okay, so questions on things we covered last time. So, since we finished up with metrics, now that we have these ways of measuring scheduling policies, let's look at some of the most simple scheduling algorithms out there and look at how they fare on some of these metrics. And we're going to focus largely on throughput and turnaround time. We'll talk about fairness next, but as we'll see, like, these schedulers really just don't have fairness in mind in a great way. And our two simple schedulers are going to be first come, first served, which is run the first thing that became runnable, that is still runnable, and round robin, which is switch between everything else. There's a question, will we review the quiz? I don't intend to review the quiz unless I'm asked questions about it. So we have these trivial scheduling algorithms here, and we're going to look at these in some simple scenarios. And to keep the scenarios really simple, I'm going to assume that we're dealing with cases where we're looking at sort of basically one CPU burst and all the programs that we can run become ready at almost the same time, but in some order. We need to know about the order because first come, first serve cares about the order. So we're going to say they become ready at the same time just to keep things simple, but we have an order that they became ready. This approximates sort of real scenarios where they become ready while the previous thing was running and we didn't decide to switch to anything else until after a bunch of things became ready. Okay, so let's look at first come, first served. So this is arguably the simplest possible scheduling algorithm, and it has no preemption. So to answer a question I just got, does this mean that if the first program is infinite, if it just uses the CPU as long as it can, will nothing else will no other program run? Yes. So it doesn't stop a program from running. So if a program wants to keep using the CPU, it gets to keep using the CPU. And sometimes you might say, "Oh, that's really bad." But this is suitable. Like, this is often used in real cases where you don't have a good context switch, anyways, where you can't switch away from a program until it gives up the CPU. Because maybe you didn't want to implement a context switch on a simpler system. And if we're using the simplest possible scheduling algorithm, maybe we'll simplify some other things, like not implement a context switch, or not implement a context switch in cases where the program isn't waiting for IO. So let's look at first come, first served. And as I said, we have to choose an order. And our scenario is that we have these three things which are ready. They all became ready at, time zero, we'll say, and A needs 24 units of CPU time before it's ready to wait for its next IO, B needs 4, and C needs 3. And one way we can think about this is that A is what we might call CPU bound. A seems to be dominated relative to the other programs by needing the processor, and B and C seem to be dominated relative to the other programs by needing IO. So if we think of the IO being with humans, they're more interactive in some sense. So with this order, the schedule we're going to get is we're going to run A because it came first. It's first on our list, then B, then C. And we're going to examine the turnaround times. And the turnaround times here are if everything became ready here. So our assumption is everything became ready at time zero. If that's the case, then our turnaround time for A is from 0 to 24. Our turnaround time from B is from 0 through 28. And our turnaround time for C is from 0 to 31, which means our mean turnaround time is 27.7. And first come, first serve, especially when we have these things which will, if we let them, use the CPU for a long time, is very sensitive to the arrival order. So, we said these all became runnable at time zero, but if we got them in a different order, we'll get this very different schedule where B and C have much lower turnaround times, and A has a higher turnaround time, but as a sort of a ratio, A didn't lose as much compared to B or C, or what B or C gained, I should say, in this alternate order. So here, because we assumed everything became runnable at time zero, our turnaround time for B is 4 units, and for C is 7 units, and for A is 31 units. So questions on the turnaround time calculations here, or assumptions, and this big difference in sort of mean turnaround time we're seeing here. Okay, So we're going to go back to this effective order later, because it's going to be important when we think about, well, what if we want to like make this turnaround time always be one of the good cases? But we can call this sort of a convoy effect. What you can think of is that we can have a convoy of threads waiting behind this very long thread. And that's a scenario we'd like to avoid. And later on, we'll think about how we can systematically avoid it. Here in first come, first serve, we're kind of depending on the luck of the draw, that if all these programs become ready at approximately the same time, it's kind of random what order we're going to get them in. And we don't want that. We want to actually sort them in an intelligent way. Okay. So next, I'm going to talk about round robin. And round robin is going to fix this problem that if we have a program that runs first, that's going to use the CPU for a long time, then nothing else gets to use it. And it's going to do that by being what we'll call preemptive. So preemption means taking a resource away from something. So first come, first served is non-preemptive because we don't take away the CPU from a program. We let it use the CPU until it's done. Round robin is going to be preemptive. We are going to take away the CPU from a program, even though it could keep using the CPU. And the round robin policy is that we're going to run a program until either it's done, like we did with first come, first served, or it runs for too long. And when that happens, we're going to switch to the next program. You know, then switch to the next program in the list. So this is, if you remember how XV6's scheduler worked, this is XV6's scheduling policy. They didn't like write out explicitly what that is, but this is what their policy turns out to be. And this requires preemption support. So we need a way of interrupting programs. XV6 sets up this timer that goes off periodically. So that's how it achieves it. And the length of that timer determines what XV6 thinks is too long. That, you know, if you go run for long enough that a timer interrupt happens, that's too long. We might imagine that if we were being more systematic about this, we would set that deliberately. And it also like requires a good way of interrupting, stopping programs in the middle. We need actual context switch support. We can't rely on the program stopping itself. But XV6 has that with context switches that can happen in the middle of, you know, a loop that doesn't try to use the OS. So here I'm saying round robin, where we have our notion of too long is one unit of time. So here I'm saying that that's what I'll call our time quantum, that we've said that one unit is the maximum amount of time we'll let something run. And we'll switch between things in that. And we say we have the programs in some order, and we're going to run the first one, then we're going to go to the next one in the list, and when we run out of things, we'll go back to the beginning of the list. And again, I have the simplifying assumption that everything becomes runnable here. At time zero, and that nothing, you know, that once the things finish running, they are done for as long as we're concerned. They're not going to become runnable again at some point in our timeline. It's going to be sometime after time 31. And we can see here that we got this sort of fast alternation where we, you know, run A for a little, B for a little, C for a little, and we keep doing this until eventually, you know, C only needed 3 time units, so then we don't keep running C. B only needed 4 time units, so after it runs 4 time units, we don't keep running B, and eventually A is the only thing we can run, so we just keep running A. And the order we get things in affects things slightly, But it's a much smaller effect because we have this rule that we don't run anything for more than the time quantum we've chosen, which in this case is 1 unit of time. And this means our turnaround times are much more regular. So again, remember, things became runnable at time zero, so I'm measuring from time zero until when they finish and give up the CPU for the CPU burst. We can see that it's much smaller. Yeah, there's not much. There's a little bit of variation from having an order that runs A later, but not that much. So there's a question, how does the timer keep time? So there's some hardware which has a circuit that typically just, you know, counts some thing that like makes it has a periodic signal, and when it reaches a certain count, basically it triggers an exception. And the OS can typically configure how what that count should be that should trigger an exception. And that would be how the OS would adjust the time quantum. In the case of XV6, XV6 just chooses a number for when those exceptions should happen, and they happen every that unit of time from boot onwards. But an OS that's a little more concerned about being precise about its scheduling policy might adjust that, as we'll talk about in a bit. And there's a question, like, what's the effect of increasing time quantum? So we can look at that. So here, saying we have time quantum of 1 versus a time quantum of 2. So with a time quantum of 2, I run everything for 2 units of time, or until it can't use the CPU anymore. This is why here C only runs for 1 unit, because we've run C for 1, 2, and it only needed 3, so after it's done its third, it's done. And it looks like, well, for the most part, you know, we're just being less fair by running with a larger time quantum, but something I didn't adjust for here is that our throughput here is a lot worse in this case than this case, because I haven't shown you the overhead of context switching yet. Here we have a whole 11 context switches, whereas here we have 6 context switches. And each of those context switches is going to take a certain amount of time. And so we're going to expect to have lower throughput, and the actual finishing time will be a little later for this case than this case. And this would also have an effect on the turnaround times, yes, to answer a question. Here in these diagrams I've shown you so far, I just haven't tried to do anything about that overhead, but because I haven't like figured out what it would be, but there would be overhead. And we want to be concerned about it. And that's a reason why we're not going to, you know, just set the time quantum to the smallest possible number. So, questions about the schedule here? Okay. So, that's round robin. And we might say, you know, what should we choose for the time quantum? And we can kind of think of this as a continuum. That if we think of having the time quantum be infinite, round robin just turns into first come, first served. Because if the time quantum is infinite, we just run things until they give up the CPU. That's exactly what first come, first served does. And when we have a shorter quantum, the shorter we make it, the more context switches we have, and the more the order in which things came in doesn't matter. And in that sense, things are fair. That you know, it doesn't matter what the order was. So that's one way we could try to define fairness. It's probably not the best one, but in that sense, we get something more fair with worse throughput when we have round robin with this shorter time quantum. And I guess I should mention another way we can sort of quantify how fair things are, is that with the shorter quantum, you know, we're guaranteed to run at least once after a certain amount of time. So with a short quantum, we can say, oh, I'm going to have to wait at most this many units of time before I run, whereas with a longer quantum, that becomes an untenable amount of time. So if we're doing something round-robin-like, and most real schedulers that are used in like desktop or systems or like phones aren't round-robin, but they have this idea of having this time quantum and switching between programs like round robin does, we have to choose like what's a good amount of time to run something before switching to something else. And to think about this, we need to think about, you know, what the impact of this lower throughput is. So that involves knowing what's the actual overhead. And this is a bit tricky to measure, but typical numbers are, on a modern desktop-like system, are between like 0.01 and 0.1 milliseconds. There's this big range because most of the cost of the context switch is not actually in the saving registers and restoring them, but is indirect costs like cache misses. Because when we switch from one program to another, our processor caches do not have stuff for the program that we're switching to, and we're going to spend extra time from the cache misses to bring that stuff in. So when people try to take that into account, this is the sort of numbers people have measured for context switch overhead. And typically when people actually choose a time quantum for round robin or related scheduling algorithms, they're going to try to manage this overhead to be an acceptable percentage. So historically, like, ranges I've seen are like 1 to 100 milliseconds. You know, and if you think of this, you know, you might be getting like 1 to 0.1% overhead. Currently, Linux's default ranges between 0.75 and 6 milliseconds. And Linux varies this based on the number of active programs. So if there are more programs, it uses a shorter time quantum. If there are less programs, it uses a longer one. The idea being that we want to make sure that no program doesn't get to run for a long time. But you don't want to go too low because, you know, 0.75 is already making this, if the overhead of it's on this range, you know, it's a large percentage of our time is spent paying the cost of switching between programs. So this tells us that this analysis that we can, you know, that we have higher throughput on this end, less fairness on this end. We've learned how we can, like, make an estimate of, like, how bad the throughput is. But I had this other metric I talked about, which is turnaround time, and I didn't put anything about turnaround time on this. So we're going to think about that. So we have a question here. So let's ignore context switch overhead. And I'm asking, given, if assuming we're ignoring that, if I decrease the time quantum, what will happen to turnaround time? And question is whether the context switch overhead I talked about, is that hardware dependent? The context switch overhead is hardware dependent and depends on what you're running, because so much of it is how many cache misses you're going to have. And that depends on what the how much like memory the program is using and then what sort of access patterns. Okay, so looks like we have... most people want these first few answers. So let's go through some examples here. So we need to think of, like, how could it decrease or increase? So I'm going to start with how could it increase. And I'm going to use for this all scenarios where we have, like I've shown in these simple examples before, you know, we have two things starting at time zero. And we're going to run them with a round robin. Two or more things starting at time zero become runnable, and we're going to run them with a round robin policy with various time quantum. So for increasing, my simple example is I have A and B. They both become ready at time zero. A happens to be first, but that's not actually relevant. And they both have a 1 unit CPU burst. So they're both going to use 1 unit of CPU and then they're done. And if we have a time quantum of 1, this is just first come, first serve. We run A and then we run B. If we have a time quantum of 1/2, we run A for half a unit of time, B for half a unit of time, A again for half a unit of time. And we have a higher mean turnaround time because here A requires a turnaround time of 1 unit, B requires a turnaround time of 2 units, versus here A has a turnaround time of 1.5 units and B has, again, 2 units. So questions about the calculations here? Now, turnaround time can also decrease, and a simple example of this is if we have A and B are two things that, again, arrive at roughly the same time. A has a 10-unit CPU burst, and B has 1 unit, and if we have a time quantum of 10, B has to wait 10 units of time to run, so its turnaround time is 10 plus its 1 unit. If we have a time quantum of 5, B has to only wait 5 units of time to run. And it can also stay the same. Easy way of demonstrating this is with our first example, but with a time quantum that's much larger than anything could run for. So our correct answer here, or best answer, is that all of these are possible. Questions about how I figured that out? Okay. So this is going to give us some insight into how we can think of actually optimizing turnaround time. And one thing we've learned is that, well, the idea of this time quantum doesn't actually help us. That it's kind of orthogonal to whether we're going to have a good turnaround time. But something we saw earlier was relevant. Which is that the arrival order mattered. So we can look at different arrival orders, and I'm measuring here wait times, which is the time it spends not running, and turnaround times. But we'll focus on the turnaround times, since that's what we measured here. And we can see that when we run the shortest thing first, we have the lowest turnaround time. And when we run the longest thing first, we have the longest mean turnaround time. And I'd say, well, why is this happening? And what we can think about is that B and C here are waiting for everything before them to run. And the longer the things before them take, the more total waiting time we add to all these turnaround times. And so what we want to do to minimize the turnaround times is run the thing that will get off the CPU as soon as possible first, which would be C, because that 3 units of time C takes, well, B and A are going to have to have that included in their turnaround times, but having B and A use those 3 units is better than having B and C have to include A's 24 units of time in their turnaround times, which is what we get by putting A first. So the policy we get overall here is that to get the best mean turnaround time, we run the shortest CPU burst first. And if we wanted the worst one, which we probably wouldn't, we run the longest. And this is for the mean or the total. Optimizing the mean is the same as optimizing the total. So equivalent statements. And a way of thinking about this is that it's kind of a race to go to sleep, that we want to run the thing that will give up the CPU as soon as possible first. And the other way we can think about it is we want to minimize the time spent waiting. So this wait time here is the amount of time we're not running before we finish up our CPU burst, that anytime something else runs before us is time we're spending waiting. So we want to run things that will contribute as little as possible to the time spent waiting. So there's a question in this calculation, aren't I assuming that, you know, it's equally valuable for, it means they are equally valuable in the sense that, like, I'm treating their differences in turnaround time the same? Yes, because I'm measuring the mean turnaround time among all the programs I'm writing. So that implicitly says that I'm saying that each CPU burst, each time we're measuring that turnaround time, you know, that's equally important program compared to anything else. And you can quite reasonably say that that isn't the right metric, but that's not what we're looking at. So we're going to use this observation to later on make a scheduler that actually minimizes the mean turnaround time. But first I'm going to have a bit of a diversion, but questions about sort of this idea that if we want to minimize the mean or the total turnaround time among all our threads, the policy we want to do is we want to run the shortest CPU burst first. Okay, so we're going to go to what might look like a different topic, but we'll relate back to this question of mean turnaround time, which is a completely different scheduling metric that we didn't talk about. So one thing that comes up on like a shared system is that I might say, well, it's more important that users who are like typing commands interactively get to run than that, you know, big like ray tracing task someone's running that's going to take days, you know, runs a little faster. So we might have this policy, our sort of the policy you want to have is that, you know, shells like run ahead of big computations. Another example policy we might have is we have a system in the department that's shared between, you know, students and faculty. We might say, well, faculty are going to be more effective at complaining to the IT staff, so maybe they'll prioritize faculty programs over student programs. And there's a relatively simple scheduling algorithm we can think of for this, which is that, well, we'll just schedule shells or faculty programs before these other programs. And this leads us to sort of a common type of scheduling algorithm known as priority scheduling. And basically, what we'll say is that we'll have a bunch of priority levels. In this example, I'm saying I have 16, and we'll assign every thread or process to every thread to one of these priority levels, and we'll have a queue, a ready queue for each priority level. And our scheduling algorithm is that we'll look at the highest priority level, which has something that's ready, and we'll take a thread at that priority. How do we choose one of the things on the queue at that priority? We'll use some other scheduling algorithm. So we could use round robin, we could use something else, but if they're at the same priority, we'll have a second level decision to decide between them. So this sort of scheduling mechanism is good when we have these sort of value judgments where some programs are more important than others, and we want to run them first. There's a question, for example, is control alt delete highest priority? So one example of priority scheduling might be if that system messages could be higher priority. Yes, so you could have other reasons for the policy like that. But this is sort of a choice that's going to be made by our system administrators and or OS authors about what gets set to what priority. And so this scheduling algorithm is a way of implementing a lot of scheduling policies depending on how you set these priorities. So something which is an important detail about doing priority scheduling is that usually when we do this, it's going to be preemptive. Remember, preemptive means that we preempt or interrupt, take away the CPU, you know. When something higher priority comes along. So if a high priority program, so let's say we didn't have any program running at priority 15, which was our highest priority, and a program was added, we would run that immediately in a preemptive version of this priority scheduling, which is usually what you'll see, because you know, you want to run the most, if you have the notion that it's more important, you want to run it as soon as you can. And the question, with regards to the implementation of priority scheduling, how is storing a process's priorities handled? Would it just be an extra variable struck within the process object? That is an option. More typically, there will be separate like link list or something like that that are for each priority level if there's a small number, or like a queue sorted by priority of all processes, because we don't want to scan through all processes to find the highest priority one. We want to have a data structure where we can quickly look that up. And there's a question, would it be useful to have different time quantums for different priority levels? So yes, we will talk later about how it might be useful to have different scheduling policies within each priority level. A question, do programs define their own priority levels? So generally, the priority of a program is going to be set by the system administrator or by, you know, some decision a OS programmer made that a system administrator did not override. It's not going to be something the program chooses because, well, we might, well, it's not, I guess the program could choose it, but it's not going to be something we're going to let programs arbitrarily choose on the notion that we probably don't want to have every program just decide, oh, I'm the most important program. At least not on a shared system. On a single user system, maybe you'd let that happen. Okay, so we have this idea of priority scheduling. So I have a hypothetical scenario with priority scheduling here. And I have two threads. So thread A is running this infinite loop where it does some I/O, like gets something from the network or a disk, uses the CPU for 10 units of time, does some I/O, uses the CPU for 10 units of time, and so on. And its I/O each time takes one time unit, like it makes a request to the disk, gets a response one time unit later. And it's at the highest priority. We have Thread Z at the lowest priority. It's just trying to get a big computation done. So it's going to use 4,000 units of CPU and then it terminates. My question is, how long will Z take to complete on this system? Give another 10 seconds or so. Okay, so a plurality, if you have said between 2,500 and 25,000 and about 62,000. And the way I'd look at this is that A uses the CPU for 10 units of time, then it stops using the CPU to wait for 1 unit of time for I.O., then uses the CPU for 10 units of time, and it always gets to use the CPU right away because it has the highest priority. So the only time that the CPU is free for thread Z to run is when A is doing I.O., and it will run in that time because it's the only other thing which can run. I should say threads. So every 11 units of time, it's going to run for 1 unit. So our total sort of efficiency here is that we're going to run 4,000 times 11 units of time. So it's going to take about 44,000 units of time. I say about because we don't know whether like A starts by doing IO or not, so it could be off by one. Questions about how I did that computation? I'm not seeing any, so let's do alternate version of this. Here, sorry, I will reopen that. So now we have a thread B, which is the same pattern as A, but it has a second highest priority. another 10 or 15 seconds. Okay, so most people have chosen the correct answer, which is, well, I said more than 390,000 units of time. But, you know, the true answer with this scenario is forever. And what's going to happen is, well, A runs for 10 units of time, and B runs in the 1 unit time gaps that A has where it's waiting for AO. And this is going to happen eventually, you know, 10 times. And then B is going to complete, and most likely it's going to do its I.O. overlapping with A running. This is not guaranteed to exactly overlap. I'm, like, assuming that this is, like, exactly 1 unit-ish. But, you know, so maybe their I.O.s would end up overlapping if the timing was slightly off. But basically there's going to be absolutely no time for Z to run. Quite possibly literally no time. So it's possible that Z will never get to run. And this problem is known as starvation. Well, arguably a problem. You might say, is it a problem? Z had the lowest priority. Of course it doesn't get to run. Threat A and B are more important. They should get the work. But that's, you know, a probable outcome is that Z doesn't run because its lowest priority, it gets what's known as starved. So question is, how long does B run in A's I.O. periods? So since each of A's I.O. periods is 1 unit of time, it gets 1 unit of CPU done in each of them. Assuming that we are ignoring context switch overhead, this means that it needs about 10 of those periods, and then it finishes and, you know, does an I.O., which means that probably there, like, if these are exact amounts of time, there's literally no time for Z to run. Maybe if it's, like, really, it's, like, you know, 9.8, we'd have, like, a little sliver of time for Z. So the question is, if Z doesn't run, does that make this thread scheduler bad at its job? Well, let's go back to my justification for this priority scheduling algorithm. If A and B are faculty programs, which are more important than student programs, well, of course they should run instead of student programs. The scheduler did its job perfectly. The problem, the why you might complain about this, is that this is not very fair. And this is a big reason why when I was introducing metrics for schedulers, I talked about fairness, because you can easily get into these scenarios where you're trying to optimize some scheduling goal, and because you never cared about fairness, it turns out you make things in an intuitive sense really bad, even though we've done the best possible job at achieving our scheduling goal. Or prefer scheduling goal, but it's because we had the wrong goals. If you think of that, it's bad to have a program be starved of resources. So a question, is it possible that Z is run every 100 CPU units when both A and B are doing I.O.? So if these times are exact, it turns out that we get a case where B does 1 unit of CPU and then does I.O. at the same time that A becomes runnable. And so there's not actually a gap. But if these numbers are slightly off, then there would be a bit of a gap and Z would get to run a little bit. But it would probably still take more than, you know, 400,000 units of time to actually do its 4,000 units of work. It would get, like, less than 1% of the CPU, most likely. Does that answer that question? Okay. So we went to one extreme of our sort of most unfair scheduler that we could possibly have, So let's go to the other extreme and talk about doing fare scheduling. And I'm going to talk about one particular way of doing fare scheduling that we're going to implement. We'll probably talk about Linux's scheduler, which is fare in a different sense. But one idea of fare is that it's fair if every thread has an equal chance to be chosen. So if that's our intuitive notion of fare, that's our definition, then there's a scheduling algorithm which comes directly from that, which is that we just choose something uniformly at random. So that's the scheduling algorithm. We have a list of the things we can run. We run one of them chosen at random, and it's fair. Everyone had an equal chance. So that's a real scheduling algorithm that we could use. And we're going to try to extend this a bit. So when we talked about priorities, you know, we wanted to say that some things are more important than other things. But when we did the priority scheduling thing, it turned out that we said that in this very strong sense that, you know, made things really unfair. So let's do something in between. So we're going to say if thread A is twice as important as thread B, whatever twice as important means, we could say maybe that means thread A should run twice as much as thread B. And we can achieve that by making a random choice between A and B that's weighted. And this is going to be known as giving it as proportional share scheduling, that we're going to give each thread a share, its own portion of the CPU time, and we're going to choose that, you know, based on some metric like decided by the system administrators or the OS programmers. But, you know, we'll have some idea of how we decide what's more important than the other. And once we quantify that, our scheduling algorithm is going to be to make this weighted choice. And this idea is known as a lottery scheduling. And it's what we're going to have you implement in XV6 as the homework assignment after the shell assignment. So in this model, every thread is assigned a certain number of lottery tickets, as we'll call them. And we're going to hold the lottery where we're going to choose one of these tickets to decide what thread to run anytime we have to choose between multiple threads. So for example, if A has 100 tickets and B has 200 tickets and C has 100 tickets, we've decided that B is twice as important in some sense as A and C. And to decide what to schedule, we're going to choose a random number from 0 to 400. And if it falls in the 100 to 300 range, that's one of B's 200 tickets. B gets to run 0 to 100. A gets to run 300 to 400. C gets to run. And that's our scheduling algorithm. So questions about this lottery idea? So if we think about the impact of doing this, what we'd imagine is that basically, if A, B, and C are similar programs, we'd imagine that B would get to use twice as much CPU as A and twice as much CPU as C. So A and C would run for roughly as long as B gets to run. So there's a question, doesn't this ignore turnaround time? Yes, this doesn't try to take into account sort of interactivity at all. And there are things we can do about it. That we'll talk about a specific version of that when we talk about the Linux scheduler, probably Thursday or next Tuesday. But that is indeed not a type of fairness we're being concerned with. Now, something nice about this idea of holding a lottery is that we can implement lots of different policies by adjusting the number of tickets we assign. So for example, if we wanted to implement priority scheduling, we can approximate that in a very well by just assigning these wide ranges of tickets. So if we want to have A is high priority, B is second priority, and C is third priority, we can give A 1,000,000 tickets, B 1,000 tickets, and C 1 ticket, and that's going to be very close to that priority scheduler. And more usefully, we can kind of tune this knob as far as how close we are by just adjusting what this ratio is here. So we can make this fairer and less priority or more priority by just adjusting that and kind of interpolate some point between we'll starve the low priority thing versus we'll implement priority strictly so you really get, you know, an advantage for being higher priority. So questions about this approximation idea? And I've shown implementing priority, but we could express a lot of scheduling policies as this lottery scheduling by just setting our ticket counts appropriately. And also, when we looked at priority scheduling, we can specify a lot of scheduling policies as priority scheduling by setting our priorities appropriately. So these are very flexible sort of scheduling algorithms, which we can use to implement actually a lot of different policies depending on how we set these parameters. So this question, is the lottery held at discrete time quantums? In the version we're going to implement, yes. We're going to just say that we're going to make you do this lottery every time that XV6 would normally switch to another program. So that's going to be when a timer expires or when a thread gives up the CPU. So in a better version of this, we might try to implement some sort of preemption. We're just not going to have you do that because the sort of math between what sort of lottery should you hold for that is a little complicated and not a detail we're interested in. And a question, are the tickets spent when a program uses the CPU? We're not going to try to penalize programs for having been on the CPU. So no, we're just going to say that you set the number of tickets a program has, and that's going to be fixed until it's changed by another call to set the number of tickets. We could imagine that if you're trying to implement a particular policy, maybe you want to adjust the number of tickets you give each program in some more dynamic way, but that's not what we're going to do. We're going to say that the system administrator, by making programs make set tickets calls, is going to configure the number of tickets, and you're going to implement that. And question, it runs the lottery every time a program ends. We're going to run this lottery every time the scheduler gets invoked. And in XV6, that happens when a program gives up the CPU to wait for I/O or a timer interrupt happens. Other questions about this? So our assignment, we're adding lottery scheduling. We have the system call to set the number of tickets the current program has. Also, we're going to have you implement counting of how often a process is scheduled, because otherwise it's actually really hard to tell if your scheduler changed anything. And we're not going to try to do anything clever with adjusting the time slices or anything like that, or dealing with preemption. So we're just going to change the round robin decision of always run the next process to instead choose a process based on the number of tickets. And you might imagine that, you know, if you wanted to use this for a real OS, you might change these details a bit, but we're just keeping things simple because the primary goal of the assignment is to get familiar with how the scheduler works in XV6. That's what we'd like you to do. Now, lottery scheduling actually feels like kind of a silly scheduling algorithm, and it's not used very much, but it was actually seriously proposed in 1994 in a very well-known academic paper, which also discusses things that you don't need to do, like how to make it efficient, like how do we If we have like 10 programs that we're holding a lottery between, how do we figure out which one won quickly without like doing a linear search? It also discusses how to add preemption, which we're not going to do, and how to deal with things like what if a program gives up the CPU, how do we still make it fair? We're not going to worry about that. And the reason why academics at least really like it is that it's a really elegant mechanism that can implement a lot of policies. It doesn't require tracking a lot of state in the same way that many other scheduling policies do. But it has some problems which make it not so great. And one we're going to talk about here. So, let's say I'm doing lottery scheduling and I've assigned, I have thread A, which has one ticket, and thread B, which has 9 tickets in my lottery. And I have 10 time quantum, so there's 10 times where I decide the next thing to run. And my question is, what's the probability A runs for at least 3 quantum? So if you think about how this should work, on average, A should run about once out of the 10 times, and B should run about 9 out of the 10 times. But it's random, so that's not always going to happen. And I see a big difference between the early and later responses, which I guess is because some people tried to answer without calculating things. It is very hard to come up with the correct answer to this without doing some sort of, with an approximately correct answer without doing a little bit of calculation. We're not going to like test you on this calculation because this is really a probability topic, though you should know how to do it if you took probability, I hope. I hope to teach this. Give another 20 seconds or so. Okay, so a majority of you think less than 1%. And that intuitively makes sense because you think, oh, if this is off by a factor of 3, that doesn't happen very often. But if we actually do the true calculation, or because I never trust when I try to do a probability calculation that I've chosen the correct distribution, if you do a simulation, you'll find out that the answer is about 7%. And so if you took probability, this is a binomial distribution, and you can compute with the formulas for a binomial distribution, you know, what the probability that A runs each particular number of times. And another thing that's notably weird that we find out is that there's a 34% chance that A runs 0 times out of those 10 times. And well, why is this? Because that's going to be 1 minus 9 tenths to the 10th, because this is the probability A doesn't run each time, and it's an independent decision each time, so that ends up being that calculation, so that's how I got the 0 times, and for 1 time, we do a calculation where we're it's kind of similar to that. That's sort of the general pattern that you'll see in the binomial distribution formula, is that we're kind of thinking, you know, if it gets chosen, you know, we have a 9/10 chance of not being chosen, 1/10 chance of being chosen, and we multiply those together. But this is sort of the results we get. And this three or more, this is more than 7% of the time. And this is kind of actually pretty bad if we're thinking about using this as a scheduling algorithm on a real system, because it means that we're going to have kind of very variable performance, which is generally not something we want. We want to have it be more predictable. So there's ways of doing something which has the same sort of goal of giving A, say, 1/10 of the time, and B, 9/10 of the time, which we can do without having this sort of variance. And the Linux scheduler is basically a scheduler which does this. Okay. So that's on that. So we'll probably talk about the Linux scheduler sometime later. But for our last 3 minutes, I'm going to talk about minimizing turnaround time again. So we mentioned before we had our diversion into priority and lottery scheduling that running the shortest CPU burst first minimizes turnaround time. So how can we do that? Well, we run the shortest CPU burst first. We just order the processes by their CPU burst length and run them first. So priority scheduling orders them by something. So we'll set their priority based on their CPU burst length. So it's exactly priority scheduling, but where we order by the CPU burst length. And there's something we have to deal with, preemption, for this. We're going to talk about that next time in detail, but the big issue is that if we're just ordering by how long their CPU burst is, this doesn't deal well with the case where something has done half their CPU burst and has half of it left. So we're actually going to need a priority that isn't static based on the length of the CPU burst, but is based on the remaining time, how much of the CPU burst is left, and I'll show some examples of that next time. But first, let's look at sort of the non-preemptive version of this. So here I have a bunch of programs which alternate between CPU and I/O, and we're going to say that we're doing the non-preemptive version. We're just going to run, our highest priority is B, then C, then A, because B has the shortest CPU burst. So what ends up happening is B runs, it waits for I/O, its I/O completes, and because we aren't doing preemption, it gets to run after A completes. And when, in cases like here, where both B and C are ready to run, we run B first, because it has the shortest CPU burst. But as we can see from this, we clearly actually want to do this with preemption because we have these big convoy effects that we want to avoid. We want to say, oh, this thing with a shorter CPU burst, you know, that doesn't have much left to do, needs to run next. Okay, so we'll look at how we add in preemption next time, and that's where we'll pick up. So I'll take questions before I sign off. Okay. Let's see. So question, if B was runnable by the time C finishes first CPU burst, would B run again before A? Yes. So B always, if both B and A are runnable, and we have to choose which thing to run next, we'll always run B. Um,